Welcome to Voices, the EISA podcast, the space for cutting-edge research in the discipline of international relations, and the audible companion to EISA, the European International Studies Association. This podcast sets the stage for deeper insights into award-winning papers, books, and theses, as much as it provides a room for the critical engagement with key concepts in political and sociological thought. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible. Please welcome our today's host, Polly Pallister Wilkins, political geographer and associate professor at the University of Amsterdam and board member of the EISA.
Why is US financial hegemony under threat? To answer this question, I am joined today by Tobias Fuhr and Fabian Papa to discuss the role and policies of President Donald Trump and his second administration in undermining decades of US financial power. Today's episode will draw on their recent article with Johannes Petri in International Organization, titled Dollar Diminished, the Unmaking of US Financial Hegemony Under Trump. Dr. Tobias Fuhr is a political economist and a postdoc at the Employment Relations Research Center in the Department of Sociology at the University of Copenhagen. His research bridges political economy, philosophy, and public policy. He has held positions at the European University Institute, the University of Reading, and the University of Warwick. Dr. Fabian Papa is a political economist and Leyva Hume Early Career Fellow at the University of Edinburgh. His current research focuses on the US Treasury market as a source of US geopolitical and financial power. Prior to joining Edinburgh, he worked as a fellow in international political economy at the London School of Economics. He obtained his PhD at the University of Warwick. Welcome to the Voices podcast, Tobias and Fabian, and thank you for joining today. I'm going to kick off with maybe quite a broad question, get us settled, get us started. So, considering the recent US-Israeli attacks on Iran and the threat of oil price rises, questions around the role of Donald Trump and the stability of the US financial system might seem somewhat obvious. However, your recent work has made clear that this instability is something of a feature of this second Trump administration. You have argued that the dominance of the US dollar in trade payments as a reserve currency and safe asset, and as a, if not the, global investment and funding currency, is under threat. Before we get into some specifics here, perhaps you can sketch for our listeners why it is that you think the dominance of the US dollar is under threat and why this is linked specifically to the second Trump administration.
Excellent. So I think I'm going to start us off. So first of all, thank you so much for having us. It's really great to get an opportunity to discuss these very topical questions with you. You know, maybe to start out, we should take a step back and just remember that the dollar is really the financial backbone of both the global financial system and the liberal financial order, right? And what that meant is that, you know, at least since the end of the Second World War, you know, and obviously increased over time, but that order sort of has crucially depended on, not immediately after following the Second World War, but, you know, subsequently Bretton Woods. And in the 80s and 90s, you know, we had relatively open markets, or at least capital markets. We had predictable rules. And we sort of had US leadership in providing sort of the development of a particular agenda that fostered, you know, the liberal financial order. And this, you know, even though there were various moments of crises, you know, we can think of, you know, first the Nixon shock or the global financial crisis or COVID. We think there is something qualitatively different about this crisis, right? And we're just, at the moment, we're just seeing the very beginning, but we're thinking what makes this crisis and what makes Trump different is that he seems to undermine trust in the United States as a sort of dependable actor in some very fundamental way. And, you know, this is not to say that we're sort of saying the dollar will immediately collapse or that the dollar will be even replaced in the foreseeable future. So there is no alternative to the dollar. But we think this undermining of trust will result in, at the margins, different actors, both public and private, trying to diversify away from the dollar as much as they can and to lessen their exposure to the Trump administration and, by implication, to the dollar.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think we can, if we look historically, we see this kind of increasing weaponization of the dollar over the last decade or so, with the use of sanctions and so on. I think that's just shown people that there are certain vulnerabilities in being linked into the kind of dollar clearing and payment and settlement structure. But there seemed to, you know, that didn't really lead to a fundamental reorganization of the system because of kind of network effects and because of kind of the incumbency effects that the dollar has. But you can see under Trump quite clearly that this can be exploited on a massive scale, right? And even the tariffs can be seen that way by essentially exploiting the world's going to need to export into the US, which is a huge import market. So by kind of putting up barriers there, you're also putting up questions essentially around this kind of global order and the role of the dollar within it. I think the question of the liberal international order features heavily here because the dollar is just one kind of aspect of what we might consider kind of US liberal hegemony. And that if that's under threat, we see the attacks on NATO, on that alliance, we see kind of broader questions about the trading order and all of that. It could lead to a more fundamental rethink, and Trump is a little bit of a linchpin here.
So you make clear then that the actions of this second Trump administration erode trust in the United States that is fundamental to the dollar's global role. Can you explain for our listeners why trust is important here?
I think trust is inherently important in the question of money. Money is fundamentally credit, right? You rely on your bank to give you back your money, essentially. So there must be some trust that your bank will be able to repay out your deposit. That's usually kind of institutionally insured, you know, with deposit insurance. So I'm not checking every day, is my bank about to fail or not, because I trust that the state essentially stands in for it, right? So I think it starts with the nature of money is heavily linked to the question of trust. And then we can, on a kind of macro level, we can link it to this question of the liberal international order, right? Do we believe if we put our money in, you know, US equities and bonds that we will be able to take our money out again, right? Or will we suddenly see, I don't know, barriers and fees put up, right? Again, the sanctions question, right? If we kind of interact with various actors, do we believe that this will be punished, right? I mean, the question of secondary sanctions is quite important here, right? The US is not just sanctioning specific actors, but anyone who interacts with them. And the Trump administration, for instance, has also shown to be quite willing to even sanction diplomats, right? That might be opposing them in trade talks or something, which is kind of a fundamental breach of kind of liberal norms. So I think trust is important to how we understand US hegemony more broadly, right? I mean, the hegemony kind of implies consent, and it kind of implies that we all buy into this fiction that this is a nice little world. I think Mark Carney outlined that quite nicely in Davos in his speech, right? Which is that we all essentially pretend because we all have benefits from it. But once these benefits erode, and once you no longer believe that this kind of hegemon is willing to extend these benefits to others in the system, then the question of trust becomes quite fundamental.
Yes. I mean, obviously, you know, given that we both wrote on the paper, I very much agree with everything Fabian said. Maybe I just want to sort of expand on this first point a little bit more, right? The nature of money, because I think, you know, we now, since the fall or the end of the Bretton Woods system, live in a world where money is not convertible into anything by anyone, right? So these are, you know, in some sense, paper promises. Now you can make deeper philosophical arguments that money represents future productivity or, you know, an equity state in the nation. But sort of the point remains that, you know, you need to trust that this token, if you want to call it that, will be convertible into some goods and services in the future. I was once asked recently, you know, do we really need the United States? Can we not just use the dollar? And even if the United States goes to a very bad place, we can just keep on using it. And I think that's one of the differences because, you know, if you think back really far in the history of economic thought, let's use Roman coins, right? There were gold coins and that were used long after the fall of the Roman Empire. But that was a system where money was an asset, right? Money was represented as a piece of precious metal that was sort of where people agreed that it had a certain value. Now we live in a world where money is a liability of somebody, right? It's issued by somebody. And that has a much deeper trust component to it. So I think one important point to remember is, you know, that the time, I guess, the last half a century, we sort of really have an experiment with a new type of monetary system. And this monetary and financial system is much more reliant on trust, that the institution sort of will continue to behave in ways that were once promised. And, you know, you can think of the cascading level of credits, right? So you can think of the banking system, but then also the shadow banking system. And, you know, now even the crypto system, the stablecoin system. So we're building forms of credit upon forms of credit. And that obviously creates much greater fragility, which might also mean that, you know, if you pull, you know, similar maybe to a Jenga block, where if you pull a foundational stone out, even if it's maybe only one small stone of the overall construct, it can have catastrophic consequences.
Thank you. Now, you've mentioned Mark Carney, the liberal international order. What does a decline in U.S. financial power and this erosion of trust in the U.S. as a reliable partner mean for the liberal international order?
That is much less clear, right? Because I guess, you know, what we have sort of said in the paper is that we're moving towards what we call a financial interregnum, meaning, you know, that sort of the hegemon is under attack, but no new power emerges yet that sort of can take its place, it's the United States' place. So we think what it will mean is ultimately that we move into a more fragmented system. And that can also have disadvantages because, you know, if you want to be kind to the United States, you could say that, you know, we had a, in 2007-8, we had a crisis that could have really become a second depression, but the credit provision by the Federal Reserve at least kept the worst consequences at bay, right? The global payment and banking system, even though it was under attack, it didn't completely collapse. So in times of crisis, and that's because everybody, all the globally systemically important institutions rely on the dollar. The Federal Reserve can ultimately create as many dollars at the stroke of a pen as it would like. So if the U.S. government or the Federal Reserve is willing to pass these dollars onto the respective institution, any short-term liquidity problem can be brought under control, and even solvency problems, right? If the Federal Reserve is willing to buy assets, hold them for 20 years, and maybe over that time horizon they recover, they can stabilize the system. A more fragmented system will be more difficult to stabilize. So should we be in a position where we have some kind of global crisis, the Federal Reserve may not even be able to act in ways that allowed it to stem the 2008 crisis. Now, more specifically, I think what we're going to see away is, you know, the sort of three dimension of dollar dominance we have identified. You're basically seeing moves to create some less exposure to the US dollars and US government assets on that side, right? So if you're looking at sort of the dimension of the safe assets, we're seeing some attempts to diversify reserve away from the dollar. Although it also has to be said, right, The world doesn't have another asset that is comparable. There is no other sovereign bond market that is as big as the United States. So there really is nothing comparable. So we've seen some central banks increasingly buying gold. So, you know, one of the amusing dictums you find online is, you know, people always thought of crypto as the new gold, but it turns out gold is the new gold. So you're seeing sort of moves in that. And we're saying, you know, if there's, so that movement also can bring strategic advantages. So I think if the European Union was to offer regular European Union debt issuance, you know, EU debt could possibly become another alternative. You know, the same goes for China, but China is clearly still very afraid to truly open its capital markets. So given the current geopolitical constellation, there's no real alternative, but people are, institutions and actors are trying. We also see the development, you know, of alternative payment systems. So just to mention two, you know, Project Enbridge, which is sort of administered by the Bank of International Settlements with various countries, or the CUNA project, which is between various Gulf states. So countries and institutions are trying to think, you know, how can we lessen our exposure given that all of our, a vast majority of our payments either is done in dollars and gets processed by correspondent banks in New York, which would both have to implement any primary sanctions and also secondary sanctions. And then we also see different regional arrangement or world arrangements. So you can see some people are trying to be like, well, maybe this is time to revive Keynes's idea of a sort of world banker. And some people think that, you know, maybe special drawing rights can play such a role. But I think given particularly the United States has veto power in the IMF, it's very hard to imagine that such a scenario can emerge.
Yeah, I think it's kind of important to keep in mind, in addition to what Toby said, that even the fragmented world and the diminished dollar would probably still have a big dollar component, right? If we see the world kind of breaking up more into zones, the dollar would still remain quite a big one. Like, funnily enough, if you think about it, the issue of trust comes up a lot when you think about China. China is not just the fact that the capital account is closed or that you don't have enough debt, but it's also China, for instance, is developing its central bank digital currency. And then the assumption by investors is always this will not become a big thing because we cannot trust the Chinese that this doesn't come with certain surveillance mechanisms built into it, right? So again, we have this kind of fundamental question of trust linked to money and its use. But I think what we could imagine is a kind of a fragmentation along functions as well, where we see something like trade invoicing more settled in RMB, in particular with Chinese trading partners. Similarly with European partners in the euro. But it seems that in particular, given the safe asset question, kind of wealth holdings will probably continue for the time being to be put into US dollars. To what extent the system could accommodate this type of fragmentation is questionable. We'll see. But that could be one type of fragmentation, both geographically into particular blocks and along functions where wealth holders continue to invest in dollar assets, but trade invoicing, something like this, moves onto more local currencies.
Now, we always like to think we live in unprecedented times. I think some of us would like to live in more precedented times at the moment. But why is this moment different? And have there been other moments when US hegemony, of course, tied to the role of the US dollar, has seemed under threat?
I think the obvious kind of callback is the early 1970s and the Nixon shock when Nixon went off the gold standard and kind of introduced that fiat currency system that we live in now. There was a big question of what that would mean for the dollar, and the dollar did lose a lot in value at the time, but then obviously gained a lot in value in the 1980s. But that was a very different time, and I think what we decided is that if we think about the dollar as a dominant currency, we need to think along various dimensions, right? We need to think along the safe asset reserve currency dimension, but also the funding and trade invoicing dimension and so on. And we haven't had a period in which all three aspects that we outlined in the paper have been under attack at the same time. I think under Nixon, there was particularly a question about the reserve currency status, right, in terms of its link to gold. There was no effort in any way to kind of disrupt the dollar's role in kind of trade invoicing and so on, right? There was no effort to dislodge the dollar. There was, in a way, there was an effort to break out of a system that in many ways everyone knew there were flaws, right? I mean, the Bretton Woods system didn't just collapse because the Americans acted. There were ongoing negotiations about how to manage the system, how to keep this going, how to reform it, and so on. So in that sense, we had a kind of a unilateral action, but that was based on a common understanding that there was a problem. Because obviously, in hindsight, it's easy to present it like this. But I think there is a fundamental difference to the way the second Trump administration has acted this time around, last year and this year. So in that sense, I think it is a unique moment. Of course, there are, you know, certain parallels in the past, but yeah, nothing really resembles this current moment.
And I think I'm going to sort of just add a couple of points to this. Because so when we look at these previous crises, at various historical points, commentators have predicted the demise of dollar hegemony, and it never came to pass. And even more paradoxically, right, you can make the argument that following the collapse of Bretton Woods, following the global financial crisis, the dollar ultimately emerged stronger than it had ever been. So it went from strength to strength. So I think there is an argument to be made, well, maybe this is just another time and ultimately nothing will change. I mean, we don't think that is the case. We do think that something is different, obviously, you know, time will tell. And what I guess we focus more on is that, you know, as Fabian said, the dollar or the decision to abandon gold convertibility was obviously an internal American decision, but there were also external factors that sort of seemed, or that where American policymakers felt the external factors forced their hand, right? What seems different about this is that no external actor is forcing the Trump administration to undo every pillar of the administrative state, right? So it seems like this is a situation where the fragility and vulnerability is purely internally generated with very little attention being paid to the ultimate consequences, right? And, you know, there are obviously different camps in the Trump administration. And for some, this is explicit policy, right? These are explicit goals. They want the United States to become more insular. Right, to many, particularly in the Republican camp, the idea that the Federal Reserve is the world's central bank is just heresy, right? They're like, why should we be responsible for maintaining the system, forgetting that the United States also benefited greatly from the system? But for other parts of the Trump administration, maybe just to finish that thought, you know, they may not even think about it, or it may be collateral damage to accomplish some other goals. But it does seem that sort of this willful willingness to undermine and threaten a position that does come with very large and sizable advantages, I think that's something very, for particularly many actors working in financial, I think that's very hard to understand. And so if you're a, you know, manager of treasuries or a large asset manager, and you see decision-making that is so patently against what on one level may be in the self-interest of the United States, or at least a substantial constituency in the United States, you then wonder, well, what other crazy thing could they do next, right? And I think this sort of idea that you just don't know what other crazy things the administration would do, right? I mean, maybe people didn't like Nixon, but I think nobody thought he was quite as unpredictable as the Trump administration. So it does feel like, even though it's very early days, there is something different about what we're seeing right now.
I think all of us in the IR community are struggling to understand the actions of the US, right? Because we've been trained from when we were little baby IR scholars that states act rationally and in their self-interest, right? So this is like, you know, it, not to turn us into conspiracy theorists, but you're like, is there some reason behind these kinds of actions? Like, what are we missing? Or are they really just, you know, acting in a way that we cannot comprehend and in a way that is irrational? So with that in mind, if there is a shift away from the US dollar, how would this impact our financial systems? What changes would we observe? And you talk more of an interregnum rather than a clear collapse. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe, but before I go into that, just sort of to come up, you know, sort of the idea of states acting rationally and sort of follows on from my also previous answer, is that, you know, it also should be admitted that sort of, you know, the international liberal order and the kind of financial and trade globalization we have seen had a lot of losers, right? Particularly in the United States, if you think about, you know, the Rust Belt or the working. So it is true that, you know, although it was very good for financial capital, it was not so good sort of for particular parts of the working or middle classes. Now, one of the interesting things is, right, so, and there is a, even in the United States, there's a lot of anger and frustrations about these developments. And somehow the Trump administration and also right-wing parties in general have managed to latch onto this discontent. Now, it's very questionable whether the solution they offer in any way can address the injustices or problems that have been solved. But at least for now, there is still the belief. But, you know, with the war in Iran, you can also see that belief slightly faltering, right? So the Trump administration in that sense isn't just undermining trust abroad, but it's also undermining trust amongst some of its core voters. So I think, you know, we also need to understand Trump and what Trump is doing, both explicitly or maybe with a plan and just in the spur of the moment, sort of as a response to that. And that's also some of his appeal, right? Because, you know, some parts of the US population were told for 2 or 3 decades that, you know, all of these developments will be great for them. They'll have a much better life. But it didn't turn out to be the case. So maybe there is an argument to be made that somebody needs to get rid of whatever existed. So I think, you know, it's important to keep that in mind. Now, when we talk about interregnum, I mean, I think we touched upon this at various points, but we basically see the overall idea is that there isn't any one currency or country that can challenge the position of the United States. Now, even more, it's questionable whether any one country even would want to challenge the United States. Because, you know, it does mean if you want to be the global hegemon and you want to keep that position, that during moments of crisis, some leadership is required, which will mean that, you know, you may have to financially backstop the system at various points. What we think we will witness and what we're sort of starting to see is sort of gradual and piecemeal shifts away from the US dollars in all three dimensions, right? So you see sort of a gradual reserve diversification in terms of reserves. Maybe you hold some more gold, maybe you hold a little bit more Japanese yen, a little bit more euro. So you're spreading your risks a little bit more broadly, right? Fabian earlier mentioned, you know, maybe you also see a development towards more maybe regional or payment blocks, you know, where in Europe we will use more of the euro overall. In Asia, they use more of the RMB. Maybe in Latin America, the Brazil real or something else can play this role. Maybe in South Africa, the Rand. So I think maybe, but this is very hypothetical. I mean, there we really at the very start of possible developments. But I think there's more incentive to drive these developments than at any other time in the last half a century. Now, another dimension could obviously be sort of you have sort of the growth of alternative payment infrastructures, right? So I mentioned some at the beginning. But I think also the kind of, let's say, new monetary development, be that, you know, US dollar stable coins, central bank digital currencies, various crypto assets, play into that. Now, obviously, you know, particularly with dollar stable coins, if all they do is buy US treasuries and then give out another kind of money against that, it's a question whether one more intermediary really does anything. But I think, you know, the feeling of being one further step away from kind of the risk of the US government may already do something. And now in general, you know, sort of maybe just to round off, why is that, you know, so something we emphasize in the paper is just there's very strong network effects, right, to the dollar. And that's also both why you saw the development and why it seems so sticky, right? So if you invoice in dollars, then it's natural to be paid in dollars. And if you also pay your suppliers in dollars, you might as well hold dollars. So the idea is, you know, there are just efficiency gains to be made if you do everything, if everybody in the world does everything in one currency. So that is also why, you know, there is the same way as in some sectors, you have a first mover advantage. Here you have distinct first mover disadvantages. But you can also see that once the momentum shifts, it might actually gain steam quite quickly or fairly quickly. Let's put it like that. Yeah, maybe I leave it at here.
Yeah, I think this kind of comment on state rationality is key here as well. Like, how do we understand the actions of this administration? And I mean, I do think incompetence plays a role, right? I mean, especially if we look at the Iran war and how that was started and executed and the sudden call for NATO partners to help that hadn't been consulted beforehand. And, you know, things could definitely be planned better. But I think there is a neoconservative strand in America that is very concerned about the loss of US power and hegemony on the global stage. So I think for them, there's an incentive to use that power while it still exists, right? At the same time, while in this kind of populist makeup of the Republican Party, there's not that much buy-in into the liberal international order, right? So in that sense, this ability, or its willingness to smash things is just there in a way, right? And let's seize the moment, reorder the world while we are still the ones in charge, essentially. And in a way, it's an interesting gamble because who else could do it if not the most powerful state, right? And I mean, everything we've seen is that they have gotten away with a lot of stuff, right? And then from a financial perspective, it probably makes sense to go after the Federal Reserve first, right? And try to subordinate that to the Treasury to make sure that in any kind of reorganization of kind of monetary fiscal arrangements of financing the deficit and so on, you have essentially the backing of the most powerful institution within that kind of financial system. Of course, in some sense, that has a knock-on effect on trust in the system and so on and so forth, leading to all these alternatives that we then discuss. But it's because of, you know, network effects and the strong status of the dollar, it is possibly a gamble worth doing, right? If you wanted to change the system, you might just be the one to go for it. So I think that's kind of key to understanding the administration. And on the other hand, there is personal corruption, right? I mean, this is basically a mafia in charge of the state. So there's huge personal enrichment by a small group of people, right? I mean, we saw that the other day when Trump essentially backed down from striking Iran again. And if we look at the betting market, somebody placed huge bets just 5 minutes before he made his announcement, right? Betting that the stock market would go up and that oil prices would fall. And you wouldn't place such a huge bet 5 minutes before. It would be the amount of luck needed to get this right without insider knowledge is just inconceivable, right? So we don't really need to pretend it's just plain old corruption here, you know, and profiting of this whole situation as well. So there's a certain logic to that as well, right? Trump's family will certainly end up a lot richer than they were before this administration. So that's probably also what is driving them.
I think we should have a whole future episode on the potentials of Polymarket and Kalshi for something to do with international relations, but we will shelve that discussion for another day, because quite frankly, I find it absolutely terrifying. So I'm going to ask you one final question. And as this is the podcast of the European International Studies Association, are there specific issues those of us living and working in and perhaps on Europe should consider when thinking about the decline of US financial hegemony? This isn't just me asking for financial advice. This is a more general question about should we? Are there specific things that Europeans should consider?
I think it's important to remember that Europe is deeply invested, not just in this liberal international order and NATO and so on, but also in the US financial system, quite literally. Right? European banks are huge participants in this kind of global dollar system. European investors, investment funds, pension funds hold a lot of American assets, American treasuries and so on, and equities. So we had this in January of this year, but over the Greenland episode, the question of could Europe essentially weaponize its kind of stockpile of American assets and prompt a fire sale and then get Trump to back off. And the costs for Europeans would be immense. Never mind that Europe as an actor wouldn't be able to coordinate that, because most of these assets are held by private investors, right? So it's not like the European Union could kind of prompt anyone to sell all their assets. I mean, I'm sure they could find some ways, change some regulations, put some kind of requirements around these treasuries to make them less attractive and so on. But I think it's so given this huge involvement that European actors have, an entanglement that they have with the dollar system, the American financial system, Europe is incredibly exposed, right? So in that sense, any kind of sell America narrative doesn't really work, because it would come at a huge cost, right? So I think Europe is more in the quiet quitting camp, if at all. Right. They might just try to ride it out, hoping that obviously that this administration ends in 4 years, hoping that it will end. And that, you know, we can have a return to a more liberal system while quietly working on some alternatives. But even there, I mean, Europe is famously bad at acting, I guess, as we see in the development of kind of common markets internally. So I think for Europeans, they're really sitting between the stools here. You know, they have, on the one hand, we have alternatives emerging in kind of the BRICS and China and so on, problems with Russia. And on the other hand, you have Americans as this unreliable ally that you can't really depend on anymore. So the other thing is the question of energy security, right? We see this with Iran right now quite heavily. Oil is obviously invoiced in US dollars. The US is now a huge exporter of oil themselves. So for them, there are certain benefits. Even, of course, oil prices have also risen in America, but they haven't risen by as much as they have in parts of Asia or in Europe. So for Europe, really, I guess this question of how to deal with America and how to deal with the dollar is partly a question of energy security as well, of national security, energy security. So in that sense, there would be a strategic incentive for Europeans to really double down on kind of clean tech and renewable energy. But of course, the rollout of any of that will also take a long time. So I think anything Europe could do or should do would be slow paced and would take a while. There's no immediate confrontation that the Europeans could really afford with the Americans as it is.
You know, I would second that very much. I'm maybe gonna like zoom out even a little bit more and say, you know, one thing also, what I'm going to say, I'm going to preface what I'm going to say by, right? I mean, Europe isn't a unitary actor, right? They're very different, as we saw with the failed attempt to give a loan to Ukraine. There's also various positions within not only Europe, but even the European Union. Now, one thing, I mean, and again, right, that's not something where you can actively do, but clearly creating more cohesion within the European Union to allow for more streamlined actions would be great. And maybe some, you know, the popular election in Hungary will allow that. But on another level, I think, if we really think kind of long-term big picture, I would say Europe can and should learn to stand on its own feet to a larger extent, right? Because I think you can say that in some sense, the last decades, the EU has relied on the United States, right? It's relied on the United States for defense, and it's relied on the United States technological development. I mean, if you think about, you know, what are the large European IT or tech firms, you know, on a consumer level, negligible, right? And if you think about even SETA, you know, transportation and the EV revolution, right? First, European actors were late, you know, now also partly because of Trump, they seem to be pulling back. So arguably, right, we are sort of condemning ourselves to dependency and a secondary status to China in particular in this regard. So I think, you know, there needs to be an awareness that, you know, if Europe wants to remain an important geopolitical and by implication also financial actor, there has to be some investment in future technologies, be that on the green side, possibly be that also a little bit more in defense, be that in IT, that develops some critical technologies in a way that makes the EU as indispensable or Europe as indispensable to other countries or geographical blocks as those blocks are to the EU, right? And that will require coming to terms with, you know, the demographic developments in Europe. It will mean coming to terms with immigration. It will mean coming to terms with competitiveness and sort of refocusing on, you know, questions around single market. And it will also on some level require thinking about, you know, in these new geopolitical constellations, what is not only is the right level of competences between the EU and member states, but, you know, in some member states that are federal states, maybe there also need, maybe there's a question of centralization versus decentralization, right? Because one of the things that's undoubtedly true is that, you know, decentralization can be very good for the democratic voice to reach upwards, but sometimes decision making can be slowed down. And yeah, so there's a question about, you know, how can Europe on some high level strengthen its position, but without giving up sort of the deep values to democracy and grassroots decision making that many people also see as European values.
I think that's a really fantastic place to end. That's a lot for us to think about. A lot of, yeah, maybe future episodes to come out of this discussion. I want to thank you both so much for joining us today, for your candor, for your, you know, deep explanations, especially for those of us like me who are not political economists. I was able to follow everything you said, so I feel very proud of myself. But it's probably more your excellent communication skills. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us. It's really
great. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening. Please find all information on today's interview guests and hosts in the show notes. Voices, the EISA podcast, is available on all established podcast platforms. If you liked it, subscribe now. Voices, the EISA podcast, feeds your reading lists, makes cutting-edge IR research audible.